Welcome to Bubbles and Benevolence, the podcast where we pop the bubbles to success and dive deep into the benevolent hearts of those who have achieved it. In this podcast, we'll sit down with successful business leaders, philanthropists, nonprofit workers, and more to discuss their journeys, the lessons they've learned along the way, and how they're using their success to make a positive impact on the world. So grab a glass of bubbles and join us as we explore the intersection of business and benevolence and discover what it truly means to be successful. In today's episode, we were honored to have EJ McNichol sit down with us. EJ has recently authored Will I Have to Brush My Teeth in Heaven, a book providing insights and support for managing grief. Join us as we delve into EJ's inspiring childhood, her impactful philanthropy, the insights from her book, and how she navigated through the challenges of losing two children. Stay tuned for an unforgettable conversation. Trigger warning, this episode heavily features discussion on miscarriage, infant and child loss.
We're very excited to have a wonderful new guest with us today, Emma Jane McNichol. So many reasons to enjoy having you on the show today, Emma. So thank you very much for giving up your time to come in and chat to us.
Well, thank you for letting me come. It's always lovely being here at Hamworth House. So enjoy the feel and vibe already.
And great. As you know, this whole podcast is around people that we meet along the way. So we'd love to go into that story. But before we do that, we always ask someone to share with us a bottle or the nature around a bottle of something they enjoy. So what have you brought in for us today?
I'm being honest, your generosity has brought in today, Marissa. So kind, have found me a New Zealand bottle of wine, but more important than that, a New Zealand plus Australian link. So it's called Counting Sheep, and we have it today. But that's because I discussed with you that if I ever choose a white when out and about, it's usually a New Zealand white. But if I choose red, it will have to be Australian. So it's daytime today, so we're having a blended, New Zealand Australian white.
I think it's a really interesting bottle because it says it's got the best of the Sauvignon Blanc varietals from both Australia and New Zealand. Which is kind of part of your story today.
Yes,
yeah. And I felt because children were going to actually play such a big role in our conversation, the whole nature of counting sheep, I think you must have counted quite a few sheep in your lifetime, physically and perhaps at the bedside of some of the wonderful and not so wonderful experiences you've had. So cheers to a lovely conversation and thank you for sharing with us your love of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc.
And thank you.
Let's hope for a beautiful conversation today. So now I feel like I've known you for a long time. I think from the minute that you came into the grounds of Hanworth, I felt an instant affinity with you. And maybe you could just share the story about how our paths crossed.
Yes. Well, our paths crossed because I had the joy earlier this year to finally complete a book that I've been writing for a number of years, probably over the last 10 to 11 years I've been writing this book, and finally got to the stage where it was ready to go to print and actually prepare for a launch. I live in Brisbane, have lived in Brisbane for the last 10 years while I've been writing the book and was trying to find the perfect location. I was advised various places, but I kept on coming back to wanting a place that was on the river because to me, Brisbane River is so iconic and it just is the heartbeat of Brisbane. So really wanted something that that could show Brisbane in all its sort of finest. We live Southside. My son goes to Churchy, which is very near Hanworth House. And so as an outside observer, I'd often driven past school drop-off, pick-up, all the rest of it, past Hanworth House and seen over the last 10 years developments and particularly the iconic tree, the lights at night, and just noticed it. And I hadn't realised it was accessible. And actually, it was a lovely friend, Kate Lowe, who's a contact through Churchy. Her son is actually a very good friend of my son, Tom, her Tom and my son, Tom, just texted me and said, how about giving Hamworth a try? It's worth it. I'm sure that, you know, they'd be very supportive. So I did. And again, Marissa, from meeting you when Roddy, my husband and I came to meet you as well, I just felt instantly embraced in the love and wonder of Hanworth. I also felt it because of the connection with the older properties. My parents are very into old properties. So growing up, we always lived in the old one that was done up. My dad worked long hours, but Saturdays were always restoring old houses, which were the ones we were living in, to beautiful homes. And so that idea of doing up a house and giving it back the love with the modern twist, I really felt Hamworth was it. I mean, when we came here, we just knew it was the perfect location. And then the other lovely connections, when you read the stories and also the names. I mean, when my mother from New Zealand came and saw the name Preston, wow, it meant something to her.
Yeah, so Preston was my maiden name.
Yes.
And I didn't realise that connection until the evening that you had your event.
Yes, so it's my mother's maiden name. And interestingly, when we get to talk about the book, one of the most important characters in my life has been my grandmother, and her name was Mary Maria Preston. We always laugh, Mary Mary. They were trying to give it sort of something.
Not
something
contrary.
Exactly. No, she wasn't. She was a tough lady. Beautiful lady, but yes, my grandfather, the name Preston. So my mum, when she saw that, just, yeah, I mean, she already loved the place when she saw it, but it, yeah. And also I suppose what I liked is coming to Hamworth and finding the full story, because you see it as a venue and you come here and realise you're not just promoting that. It's a home for all these visitors to Brisbane. It's And international visitors as well. And that's so much part of my story as well, because I wasn't born and bred in Brisbane, neither was my husband or son. And so to me, that idea that you're actually giving back into young people as well, that they'll have these memories, it's wonderful, really excellent. So we also felt that link. And from the moment of finding here, there was nowhere else that was right for us. And we feel very connected.
Oh, well, we so loved hosting your beautiful event, which I know we're going to talk about in a little while. But before we go there, the Preston story is gorgeous, because we always find that it doesn't matter who we tend to meet along the road that's Hamworth, there's always more to the story than meets the eye. It was just
yes.
The fact that your mother came in and saw Preston on the entry hall,
yes.
And I didn't realise the Preston connection. It was just, mm-hmm. You know, we always realise that there's all these layers of connectivity that Hamworth tends to thread them together.
It yes.
tends to have that sense. We always say it has that heart of Hamworth that tends to just weld things together in a beautiful way. So we were so thrilled. It was our privilege to host your beautiful event, and we feel very much part of your story, so much so that's why we wanted to have you have a chat to us today. What I don't know too much about, I know a little bit from the book, which I absolutely love, and I had to read it in small pieces because it's such a lot to take in. It's such an incredible journey that you've had as a family. Tell us about Emma Jane's journey. Where did you grow up?
Yes.
And was it your parents' house in New Zealand that was the old house you were telling us about?
Yes.
Tell us about growing up and yes. how you met Roddy and
yeah,
Emma Jane.
The fun side. So my name's Emma Jane, and but at a young age at school I started to get called EJ. I think people sort of thought Emma Jane was too much. So Emma Jane and EJ is how I'm referred to. I think my parents finally realised this when they went to a parent-teacher interview, and even the teachers were saying, well, EJ did this or each other. Well, that was great. We could have just picked two letters. So yes, I was born in New Zealand, but at an early age we went to Fiji. My dad worked for the Bank of New Zealand, and he was promoted to run some of the international offices. So one of the first ones was in Fiji, and we were meant to be there for 3 years, and we moved there when I was five, just turning six, and so it was going to be a wonderful stage of our life. Unfortunately, he got promoted again and sent back to Wellington, so we only had 18 months in Fiji, but I feel they were very important years for me because I was a second child. I have an older sister who's very, she's lovely. She was at the book launch, but she's very responsible and very, as every first child should be. She took great care of me, whereas I think I guess came in with confidence and boldness and Fijian life, no shoes, hot weather, just bowling about with Fijian people was really what I loved. But we lived a very privileged life there because my dad was head of the bank. And in those days, that was in the early 80s. And in those days, if you're head of the bank, you're the person apparently with the money. So therefore, he was opening all the hotels. So the bank had funded it. So he was opening the hotels. So my sister Joanna and I would get to go and stay for sort of weekends for free in these hotels, and we'd have our own suite, whatever. Mum and Dad were off socializing and we were just left to look after ourselves with, you know, the wonderful big fruit bowls and all the rest of it, and the love and warmth of the Fijian people. So I think Fiji, we had no television in those days. We just had outdoors and we just had so much love, particularly the lady Kalesi, who is my house girl. She was my best friend. So she was an older lady who cared for our property, which is very common in Fiji for visiting people to have house girls. It was a common business, but she was really brought in as part of our family. So she had a property on our land, and just basically every day I would spend with her, which is really lovely to think of. So I think coming back to New Zealand then when I was, must have been 7, almost 8, it was a hard adjustment. Came back to Wellington and lived very central, right next to the university there in Calburn and Wellington. And I went to school there, to the same school. I went to a girls' school called Samuel Marsden Collegiate School. And, yeah, I loved school life, really, really enjoyed it. My interests were sport, but also more the theatre side. I think that I probably would have taken the sporting one further if I hadn't got jobs in cake shops on Saturday, so it meant that I couldn't turn up at the at the sporting field. So although my family used to enjoy me bringing those goodies home afterwards, but yeah, I sort of got involved in anything I could within the hours that I wasn't doing other sort of working jobs. But yeah, no, I really loved it, and progressed through school and actually was the head girl of the school. I remember it was one of those schools, it was a private girls' school in New Zealand, and was one of those ones that did receive a bit of sort of the private school, public school banter that happens. I used to always think, no, there's not snobbery at the school, not with the girls when you know them one-on-one. Parents, maybe, not the girls. So I just really think I was very, very fortunate to have that wonderful opportunity to be in an education that gave me everything I enjoyed. So a lot of time on the stage. So I did theatre, got colours in that, and debating. So really enjoyed that. And theatre sports was the other wonderful thing that we got introduced to. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. So I think that I always wanted to travel, though, having lived in Fiji, and then also having had spent a little bit of time in the UK when we were 4. My dad had sabbatical, so we spent about 4 months on the canal boat system and then traveling round England. So we really loved it. And so in my mind, I'd always come from a family that wasn't just New Zealand centric. So I always knew there was a bigger world and places to travel. I may not have told my parents this. So basically by the time I got to the end of school, I did apply for what's called the GAP program. I got accepted as one of the New Zealand representatives and went to the UK, to England, and I was a matron in a boys' prep school at the age of 18. So, yes, I had to grow my hair and have it up in a bun to look a little bit more strict and stern. But, look, it was lovely. I was at a school called Winchester House School, which is a feeder school to some of the other sort of well-known public schools in England. But I saw the little boys from age 6 in boarding school, and I was their matron, but also tried to be the big sister mum figure for them. So we would sometimes sit in the dormitory with, say, 10 young 6-year-old boys, whatever, and they're all a bit homesick maybe. And we would sit and we'd look at I remember one boy had a map on the wall, and they would tell me where their family came from, and I'd show them all the way over to New Zealand. That kind of stopped their homesickness. They felt more sorry for me. But I was really fortunate there. That's where I met other good friends that have been friends for life, and some of them, like my friend Melissa, is one of the ones who was at the book launch but also is part of the book, having known her since I'm 18, and her having seen me and my just who I am and knowing me and still being my friend right to this day.
It must have been quite challenging being an 18-year-old,
yes,
in charge of a group of boys.
Yes.
I mean, were you quite kind of self-sustainable? Did you know how to cook? Did you have to know any of that stuff? Or did you have to just play the role in, yes, a theatre sports style that the boys thought you knew what you were talking about?
I always remember I had a good friend from an older friend who was like a bit of a mentor to me back in Wellington. And he wrote to me, even though we would see each other regularly, he actually wrote to me a letter before I went. And he said, the secret with boys, he said, is to be firm but fair. And he said, if you remember that, he said, they will respect you. I was only 18, but I remembered that, and I remembered firm but fair. And it was true. You had to set the boundaries. So bedtime is whatever bedtime is, and you stuck to it. And they would complain, but you would stick to it. But I did find, so I was a matron, but they did also have masters, so males as well. And there was definitely some of the difficult punishment that has, that still existed in those days in the early 90s. I found that hard because I could see the vulnerability of some of these boys. And as an 18-year-old, I think I did struggle to deal with some of that because I think that system still existed then. I hope it doesn't still exist now. It did exist then. And I would see some of the frustration of some of those masters who maybe hadn't had the career they'd always wanted or whatever, maybe played out in strict punishment on those boys. And afterwards, the boys would come to me for a hug. it was difficult. And look, everyone chooses different paths. And there's certainly a system in England of boarding schools from a young age, and it works for some. But certainly some do struggle with it. So yeah, it was a lot for me to see. I think from having been a person that had grown up in a fairly sheltered life at home, head girl, everything going well, you know, great grades, all that sort of thing. And suddenly I was the matron. So the matron is the lowest in the pecking order. I remember, interestingly, from the whole sort of female side, there was another boy who actually went to the school with me at the same time. And maybe I've never quite got over this, but we were both in the same year group. But because he was male, he was sent to be a tutor and a master. Because I was female, I was sent to the laundry to be the matron. Now, the matron looks after the boys, but we also do all the washing and we do the sorting and we make sure all the beds are made up, etc. Well, we got our bursary results on the same day. And all I can say is his results were not in the same league as mine, but he was the one that was made to be the teacher. Because he was male.
It wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago.
I mean, and I think the English system particularly is a lot more kind of divided.
Yes.
Traditionally anyway.
It has been.
But did you find that quite a shock?
I did, although we had a lot more fun in the laundry. There were others. There was three gaps. So there was a girl from Canada and Melissa from Melbourne, myself from New Zealand. And then we had three or four that were local full-time matrons. So the most scary of was an older lady called Miss Pinfold, known as Miss Penny. She was put in charge of the youngest boys so that they truly learned how to keep in line. That was her facade for the boys, but to us, she was the loveliest lady. So we worked with people, you know, that are my age now, so in their late 40s or 50s, that were full-time matrons forever. And I realized then, I knew then more determinedly that everyone is equal no matter what job or role we do. So I remember one boy saying to me, what do you know, Miss Galt? That was my surname at the time. You're only a matron. And in my head, I was going, yes, but I'm going to go and study law and I'm going to go and do this and I'm going to be this and I'm going to be that. So you shouldn't treat me like that. But I actually paused and I never answered that boy in the way that was going on in my head. The way I actually answered him is, yes, I may be only a matron, but whatever I needed to tell him, this is still true. No one is only a matron. No one is only a something, whatever. We are all just as important. And really, through the sheer, I suppose, luck of birth sometimes, or unluckiness of birth, that's really what can sometimes determine a lot of things. So I think I learned a lot of good life lessons there, particularly that pause when I was going to defend myself. Oh, but I'm going to be this, that, and the other. I mean, who cares what I'm going to be next? This is me now, and we should treat each other the same way then. And also I think that's because I had matrons that were friends and they were always going to be matrons. There was no hope for them to be anything more or different. And they were good at their job. And it's a tough job to be doing into a late time. So anyway, I feel there was a lot of life lessons learned in that gap year.
And just a year you spent over there?
Yes. And then I came back to New Zealand to do that law degree. But doing just law would not have been enough for me. So I was always interested in acting. So I also did a theatre and film degree at the same time. And in the university I was at, actually, a lot of people had started that double degree, law and theatre and film, but I was the first one to actually complete it, because usually you go one way or the other. You end up being the person who is completely taken over by the theatre and stage, and some of those people are still acting today, probably, or the law just consumes you, and that is where you go. Couldn't meet two different campuses. The law degree was, if you do not hand this in, each half hour that you are late, you lose a mark. So you go from A plus to A, A minus, whatever, and so you lose. Whereas in theatre and film, you just had a chat to your tutor and, you know, oh, you know, I'm on this performance, so can I have 2 weeks to, you know. But interestingly, both of them in the end sorted it out. So even though theatre and film was very relaxed about what time you got it in, they were very, very strict at the end, and in the end of actual numbers. So first year theatre and film started at 76. Final year was only 12 of us.
Wow.
So they really cut. So you had to do well. So that might have been also why.
Did you do this simultaneously?
Yes, I did. So it was good. It kept me balanced. But probably as a result, I wasn't fully the lawyer or fully the dramatist the other end. So I still loved both.
But it tells in itself a story about you now being a novelist in
yes.
many respects as well.
Mm-hmm.
But before we go there, I want to ask you one thing about your learnings about being firm and fair
firm
on
and
boys.
Fair. Yes.
As the mother of three boys, how did that go for you?
Good in theory. If my son Tom was here to tell you, I think he would say sometimes it was a bit one way or a bit not the other. But, I did keep that in mind. I think it's still very, very valuable advice for children, probably boys or girls, but particularly for boys. I think that they soon learn the rules and they can see it. They're smart individuals. My three certainly were, and can definitely work out what they can get away with or not. So certainly remembering when it was important to stick to the rules. I think that helps in the nurturing and understanding what the world is about when you're trying to seek it out and find it out as a young person. I think to understand what works or not in your household is really important. I know there's others that would have views that a bit more freedom finds the answer, but I think understanding those rules. But also I think as a parent, understanding when the rules are not important is really, really good. I remember actually one of the boys of my son Ben, his good friend Rufus, who is briefly mentioned in the book, and there's a photo of Rufus in the book. I remember one time a funny incident. He came round to our house after school and was having a play date, and he turned up with these cupcakes, which were lovely, he'd made at school, and we had those cupcakes, they sat on the bench or whatever, and we got about of the play date, so it all went well. He went home. About 7:30 that night, his parents gave me a call and said, really sorry to bother you, EJ, but Rufus just won't go to bed until he's just a bit worried about those cupcakes. He said, do you still have them? He really wanted one. Didn't realize this poor kid had turned up with four cupcakes. So, you know, they just didn't appear during the play date or whatever. We'd given them other food or whatever, but he was very, very keen. He was refusing to go to bed without the cupcakes. And his dad drove down, and they didn't live far away, but came down and walked up the path and to collect the cupcakes to take home. I remember saying to him, you know, when they get to 21 and we can sort it out by a cupcake, we'll be glad. So, you know, like this was going to sort him out, his biggest problem in the world, sorted out by that. So I don't know. It's a funny little random thought that you have. But, you know, I was always thinking when they get older, what kind of a child are we going to produce? What kind of an adult have we produced? Is that someone you want to open your door to? And that sort of was always in my mind when I weighed up, am I going to be the firm one? Am I going to be your friend or the firm parent? That, yeah, some of my parenting techniques. Whether they've worked or not, I don't know.
The fact that you still remember that from when you were 18. Like, it's a really big learning, and I think
it was.
A- particularly significant learning to take through life. It's not only just in families but also in the workplace and those sorts of things. And also one's perception of what might be fair might be different or perceived differently by others.
That's true.
But I know there's a fourth man in your life, in your family.
Yes.
It seems you seem to be inundated with boys. But I love the story in the book about how you and Roddy met, and I wondered if you would indulge us with...
To share it.
Yes, exactly.
So Roddy, my husband, is... he's Scottish, so Roderick, he's known as Roddy. Although when he's here in Australia, his patients, he's a local GP, his patients always like to sort of shorten that to Rod. But he's definitely a Roddy to me. Yeah, so I met Roddy on a ski trip. We had met before in the organising of it. Roddy is, he came across to me at that time as just very calm, but also very much the joker of the group. So we had a lot of laughs, but he was calm in it all. So the story that Marissa is sharing, which I have shared in the book, is I kind of really realized that he was something special when on the last day of the ski trip we were skiing down, and the background to our skiing experience beforehand is that I had had no skiing experience. He had had a lot, even battled the fields in Scotland, which is tough skiing, if you know that. We were skiing in France together and we were both going down the same slopes. And one time he sort of skied over to the side and came to sort of check that I was doing okay. And I remember he said to me, "Don't worry. We have all the time in the world." And I just can remember going, wow. Like I was always chasing after the next thing, maybe, you know, what's happening next? But I'm a very much that kind of person. But for someone to actually say, doesn't matter, you know, we've got all day to get down that field. You don't have to head off now. I went, wow. That's the kind of attitude I'd like to have sometimes into my life. So yeah, I think that for me was the spark of interest. I think interestingly for Roddy, he said that over time he was wondering, because he comes from Scotland, I come from New Zealand, and we'd met in London and skiing in France. We were with a group of friends together, but he said he was always wondering whether I would want to ever even sort of think about, contemplate going out with someone from the other side of the world. So he took his time, not too long, fortunately, but I wasn't really thinking that way, because a lot of our friends, it's quite a common thing in London to meet people from various backgrounds and various countries. So you're not really thinking long term at that time. So I hadn't really thought about it. But I think when he did ask me to marry him, it was more of a reality then, because if you look at the map, he's from Glasgow in Scotland and I'm from New Zealand, and it's a long trip. But fortunately, you can now fly it. My ancestors, on my father's side, had come out from that very same location of Roddy's, and it was 3 months on a ship. My great-great-great-whatever grandfather had written a diary at that time of the three-month journey, which was not pleasant, to New Zealand. So it's no longer 3 months on a boat with a lot of sickness and sadness. So, yeah, we're fortunate to be able to keep those kind of connections. But I think it's still a big decision, because you don't necessarily automatically know each other's backgrounds. You know, we were with his family of recent, actually, have been visiting, and we were talking about cartoons you watched as children. They watched different ones in Scotland. we don't have that shared background. And I think even though we speak the same language, there's definitely a cross-cultural marriage in that situation.
He came with you the day he came to Hanworth, and I remember just thinking, what a beautiful couple you were, and met the rest of the family, or the story around the rest of the family. But we're going to stop and just have a little pause for a minute, because I want to start talking about your beautiful boys and the book, of course.
Yes.
But just before we do, I'd love you to describe each of your three beautiful boys in one sentence each. So tell us a bit who they are, and just a random sentence that you can think about before we come back and talk about their very important roles in your book.
Well, Marissa, you've caught me there, but it's a wonderful opportunity, and thank you for letting me name my three boys. Samuel, Roderick, McNichol. My problem is I don't really know you, because you never spoke to me. But as much as anyone could ever know you, I did, and I love you. Benjamin, John Galt McNichol, you were the greatest joy of this world. Thomas Daniel McNichol, you make us laugh every day, And we're so proud of you and continue to be our closest friend. Thank you, Marisa.
I feel like I know all three of them, and I know that was tough and very emotional for me as well. I think we're just going to take a little tiny break, and we're going to come back and talk about, will I have to brush my teeth in heaven?
If you would like to purchase a copy of EJ's book, Will I Have to Brush My Teeth in Heaven? It is currently available through the Booktopia website. You can also head to ejmcnichol.com to find out more about the book and EJ herself. Both the links will be in the episode description below.
EJ, I've got this very impression of somebody who's very motivated, obviously articulate, a lawyer, so you can write words together, an interesting side interest of theatre and creativity. So I guess it's little wonder that we have a beautiful book in front of us today. Have you written before, or what was your impetus to write this book?
Yes. No, I haven't written before, actually. I've written plays for university. I've written thoughts, but never actually been prompted to write a book. But after the loss, the death of our youngest child, Samuel, I just really felt like writing a book, because a lot of people said to me, we didn't know how to help you. We didn't know what to do. We just don't understand. Tell us what you need and what we could do. So I felt like there was a voice, a public voice coming to me from lots of different angles saying, we just really need to understand how to help people who in the modern world lose a child or a baby in whatever circumstances. And I felt like this list in my head, this could have been done, that could have been done, all the rest of it. It was effectively going to be a rant. You know, this is how the world treated me and it was unfair. People walked on the other side of the street, or people told me some children just weren't meant to live, or people told me other hurtful things. And that really wasn't helpful. You should have done this. You should have been like the lady who walked up to me and said in the playground, I have no idea what to say to you. I have started many letters, and every time I screw them up and chuck them in the bin, I just don't know what to say. And I said to her, you've said it all. And we gave each other a hug in the school playground, and I think she was brilliant. She never said anything, but she said everything to me. So I kind of was going to say, this is what I want to do. But then sadly for us, and I started writing that sort of book. But I'm glad I never wrote that book, because I think it just sounds like a book of bitterness, and that's not what I've learned since. So sadly, when our second son, only 18 months after Samuel died, when our second son, Ben, at age 6, was diagnosed with brain cancer, I remember very early on in his treatment, my parents had wonderfully flown over from New Zealand to England to help us out yet again. I remember my mum saying to me, you know, you're still going to write a book, but it's going to have two stories and they're going to have different endings. But they didn't. So my second son, Benjamin, at 6 and a half, died to brain cancer. And so when I was regrouping after that, I still felt this need to write, because a lot of the experiences we had had from Samuel were repeating themselves in Ben, in terms of public reaction, as in people's ability to care for you when you're grieving the loss of a child. But I felt different. I think it's because Ben had had 6 years, so I sort of wanted to share more of his life, really. So I started writing, and I didn't write beginning to end. I always remember a teacher at school, I enjoyed creative writing, and a teacher at school had said to me, just start writing and then the beginning will find itself. Because sometimes we get so caught up with, how's it going to start? What's the first words? And I remember writing it and getting caught up in certain sections. And the thing that was concerning me always was, how am I going to start it? How am I going to start it? It's all very well that, you know, this is here, but how am I going to start it? And it took a few months to come up with that. I wanted to start with something light and humorous, but also something that would draw you in. So I remembered a small incident that had happened on Samuel's first birthday, which I was only told about because I was at work. And lovely lady Debbie, who had the role of taking the boys to school in the morning and dropping them off on my work days. She was walking to school with the boys and they were discussing Samuel. Debbie had never met Samuel, but they were discussing it with her. And as was always in our household, the open conversation about Samuel, even though he had only lived 5 weeks with us in hospital, so he'd never even been to home, my boys Ben and Tom always talked about him as if he was real and true. And so they just chatted as normal. And they got discussing birth weight. And little Benny, aged only, who would have been five by then, apparently said to Tom, always because Tom's the source, the older brother's the source of all knowledge, what was I when I was born? And Ben was a big baby. So in the UK, we measure it in pounds and ounces. So he was 11 pounds and
six ounces.
And so Tom told him that. He said, you're 11 pounds, 6 ounces, because that had been something that had been discussed in the household because Ben was a big baby. But Benny didn't really know about pounds and ounces of babies, but he did know about pounds that you go to the Tesco and buy your little sweets and stuff. So he was thinking, wow, 11 pounds, 6 ounces. So he turned to Tom and Debbie and said, wow, I was a very expensive baby. I must have been a very expensive baby. So that little incident, which happened on Samuel's anniversary, his first birthday, I just thought was a lovely way of making you curious to think about our family life. And it drew it in to then talk about how we celebrated Samuel's first birthday. And a lot of the talk that happens in communities when you do lose children is, how do you celebrate anniversaries? It's quite a big thing, because you want them to be remembered, and you want them to be, anyone who has ever lost has always wanted to remember the people in special ways. And we all do it differently. And I think we need to celebrate those differences. And so the way we had to learn to do it the first time, I had no idea. I didn't know what to do and I hadn't really planned anything. But I had a beautiful situation in that a close friend of mine who had also lost a baby a few years ago turned up, and she had baked a beautiful chocolate cake and made this beautiful cake for us and delivered to it to me and said, no mother should ever have to make this cake. And it was just really wonderful. And she actually is a lady that has features in the book a few times. So she was actually going through cancer treatment at the time and had other stories. But she was a very, very influential person on me at the time, that we made friends very quickly because of the circumstances. She had thought to make that cake for me because she'd been there before.
Oh, intuitive. Which was, almost.
Yeah.
She was inspirational, yeah. But also very intuitive.
Definitely. So that was a lovely little way to be able to start it. So that's how I was able to sort of start it. I think the other key thing is the way I wrote. So I wrote the starting sort of jotting notes back in the UK at sort of early times, but quite early after the loss of Ben, we actually moved out here to Australia. That was a big decision, because interestingly, we had been thinking about it at about the time that Ben was diagnosed with brain cancer. So Roddy, my husband, actually had scheduled interviews for jobs over here in Brisbane that he had to cancel because Ben was diagnosed with cancer and we were in the UK going through what we thought was going to be 18 months cancer treatment. So when Ben died, it was almost hard to ask that question. Do we think about Australia again? And I sort of thought, I had that kind of mentality that why not? You know, we had planned it with him, so let's just see. So we actually came out to Brisbane, I think it was about the August. So Benny died at the end of May, and we came out in August for a family holiday, which was awful because it's horrible to stay in a hotel and see children interacting and see how your child would have enjoyed it in a place that he had loved. He'd come to Brisbane before and
how
enjoyed
it. How old was Tom at this stage?
Tom at this stage was 9. Yeah, so still pretty young. And he was on his own, you know, apart from two parents. He wasn't on his own, but it felt very much as if he was. And little things would happen, like, you'd go to a restaurant and people would say, only three chairs. And you'd realize they'd take away the other two or whatever. You know, like little comments that are throwaway comments that would mean nothing to the waiter moving the chairs, but meant everything to us. So it was a really difficult holiday. But what was good about it is we just let each other say, how would we feel living here? And at the end of it, we didn't make a decision at the end of that holiday. We actually had a, well, it sounds like we have holidays all the time, but anyway, we happened to have another little holiday across to Paris, in October, which was our wedding anniversary. And I don't know if you've ever seen those programs. They show them in the UK called Wanted Down Under. And it's a program where they bring British people out to Australia and they record you, record families for a week saying, how would you cope living in Australia away from your family? This is the school. We'll take you to the job. We'll take you to the house. We'll go to the supermarket, see how much it's going to cost. And at the end of it, the whole family decides. And they have a postcard on one side is the British flag. And on the other side is the Australian flag. And all the individual family members turn them and you know, close their eyes and land at which one they want to be at. And it goes on forever. There's probably an ad break in between. Well, we found one of these stalls in Paris that happened to have a postcard with the British flag and an Australian flag randomly in Paris souvenir shop. So we each got one. And we sort of said, let's make the decision that way. What do you think? Instead of just talking about it, what do you think? And I don't know if I've ever told Tom and Roddy this, but I deliberately held back an extra second because I decided I'd be happy wherever they were happy. And I wanted them to make the decision because I don't care if I have to live the rest of my time in the UK, that, you know, that's fine. Or in Australia, I will make it work wherever, as long as you two who have been through great grief and difficulty are okay. So I waited and both of them put the Australian flag. So quickly I followed suit, and I just never want to be the one that makes that decision or pushes someone into something. I just wanted to encourage the right one. So we did come.
It was a big decision for Tom to put Australia first. What do you think was the reasoning? Did he have a reason? Was he quite pragmatic about putting Australia up?
It was a huge decision because Tom to this day would still call himself English. Interesting, coming from a Scottish dad and a Kiwi mum, but growing up in England. And Tom is very sociable, lovely boy, or young man. Now he's 20. And it's not that he didn't have a whole lot of friends there in England, et cetera, et cetera. But I think he was just interested in travel, was part of it. And what was the world like the other end? And interesting, we had enrolled both Ben and Tom in two different schools here in Brisbane, one on the north side and one on the south side. And Tom, we did little interviews at both of them, and it was Tom that actually chose the south side school. So Churchy was the school he chose. I'm sure the other one would have been wonderful as well. But Tom chose that school and really felt this could work, which was amazing because he had come from a small state school in England where there was only one class per year group and it was mixed, so co-ed. So to go to Churchy, which is, I can't remember the numbers, is it 2,000 that they have, if not more? So it was a huge difference from a very small school that had been very supportive to us as well. And look, it's that whole sliding doors thing. I imagine Tom, back in Eastbourne, where we were at that time, would have been continually loved and cared for and always remembered and known as the boy who lost those two brothers. I don't think that was the reason Tom decided to come here, but he certainly has never been known as that here because it's not necessarily something he would talk about unless you talk to him about it. If you talk to him about his brothers, he would very happily talk to you about them. But it is rare for him to ever have that opportunity. And what was wonderful is at the book launch, he was able to invite some of his friends. One of them, for example, has recently said, I'm reading the book. And, you know, and it's wonderful to open that conversation for Tom as well, who has had to go through the last 10, 11 years of people thinking that he doesn't have siblings, which is not his full story. So not understanding that level of pain that he has had before. So Tom very much would see siblings interaction, and that's something I actually mentioned in the book, would see siblings interaction and be very upset. So growing up in the early years after the loss of Ben, he would get really upset if he saw kids fighting siblings. He would know if they were siblings fighting in the playground or something like that, because it would just, he couldn't understand it. He just couldn't comprehend it. Him and Ben had a very, very close friendship, which was a wonderful gift, but then makes it harder when that's separated.
I was just thinking, I know that Ben at this stage was part of your planning and,
yes,
and the, you know, holiday setup and all of that. Do you, it might be a question that you can't answer, but do you think the result with the cards would have been any different had Ben been part of the four people?
Oh, interesting. I don't think it would have been at all, because Ben was very, very keen on rugby, and Churchy is very, very keen on rugby. and also Ben loved water. So coming to Australia and having holidays. So the reason we had come here a few times is we decided it was a really lovely place to come to Brisbane and the Sunshine Coast, actually Noosa, to have holidays with my family. So we could actually not all be in, so we could all be on holiday together and not doing our sort of jobs. Because if you holiday in the other person's country in their place, they still continue doing their day jobs and things like that. So you're not fully relaxed and on holiday together. So we'd had some really lovely times together where we'd sort of spent a couple of days in Brisbane and then headed up to Noosa. Benny loved the swimming pools. In fact, only last weekend we were up in Noosa and we drove down the hill down to Hastings Street, and Tom, Roddy and I all looked at each other and said, Benny's pool.
Yes.
So I think for me it's always been lovely living in Brisbane because Ben was here and enjoyed it here. I don't think I possibly could move to a place that he hadn't been in those early stages. Maybe now I could, but at that early stages I couldn't. So I think the answer would have been the same.
So you would have been the fourth kind of vote.
Yes.
So it would have been the same.
I would have been, yeah. Outcome. Yeah, that's true.
I think both Tom and Ben would have appreciated that as
yes.
well. I was going to ask you about when you wrote. Like,
yes.
How do you, you were obviously probably working at the time. Like, how did you, I was thinking about other people who might want to put pen to paper.
Yes.
How do you fit it in, and what did it look like for you?
Yes. So my writing process has been a long process. So I did start when we moved here to Australia, started formally writing. I didn't read any books or guidance beforehand. I just was putting it, my memory of the story from my viewpoint, onto the pages. So I deliberately didn't apply for a job. I'm a lawyer and was going to apply for jobs here in Brisbane, but didn't apply for a job for a couple of months so that I could get most of it down, so that the early raw memories were there, which I think has been a great benefit of the book, because a lot of people say to me it's very raw. And it's very in that moment. Whereas if I had waited years and looked back to it, so it's not 10 years of, 10, you know, 10 years later I wrote about what happened there. No, the skeleton was certainly written in the first few months that we were here in Australia. So what I would do is, I knew no one in Brisbane. So we were renting a place in Bulimba, and Tom was started just the last term at Bulimba State School before he started Churchy for the last year of prep. So I would walk Tom to school, go for a run, and interestingly, to Mowbray Park.
Just across the road.
Then run home to Bulimba. Pretty much then would just write until school pickup time. A lot of boxes of tissues. I think for me, it's being the word cathartic. So definitely I needed to tell my story. So for me, so I wrote what I would consider a good first draft in that time, and then started working. I thought that I would be able to do more editing and that sort of thing after work, all the rest of it. But what I found is it's not easy to pick up in pieces, because you need to get into that world. So it's quite hard to disengage from your day job or from your family life, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually found that the progressive years I needed to take time off work to actually, so I would take a couple of days off. So for example, if Tom was at some camp or something like that, I actually would take a couple of days off. And it's before we had dogs. We now have dogs. So there was no distraction to my day then. So there wasn't dog walking or things like that. I would be able to write all day. So that was a way of getting to the second good draft. And then when I got to a stage where I thought, I think reading on my own, I would read this. This would be good enough. I then took it to the person I'd always had in mind, which is a girl that I had gone to school with, who was actually my deputy head girl, Lauren Quaintance. And she is a journalist and she was down in Sydney at the time. And I had connected with her and I knew that she was speaking at a festival, the Sydney Creative, I think it was called Creative Nonfiction Festival, which the title itself taught me so much. Because I'd always thought that nonfiction was writing the facts. But actually, to be creative about that is really important. So stop and think, what are the smells in the hospital? What is the colour of the furniture? What is the, you know, take the person to where you're at and what's the atmosphere actually like, was different than just saying, we went to hospital and were given a room, you know. The heat of Ben's room on the day, you know, I will never forget that when he was feeling sick and was feeling awful and it was all hot and red and just the intensity of that heat was something I wanted to share. And so I met Lauren there, and even though we hadn't kept close sort of personal contact for the last however many years, she knew me, she respected me, and she wanted to read my story. And she read it, and again, further delay. I think it took a couple of months or something like that when she came back. And the only reason that this book is published is because she started her email back to me, "You're a good writer, but." So the rest of it, I can remember I was really upset because what she was saying is, you need to think of your audience. She said all the completely right things is, EJ, your head's all over the place. You need to think of your audience. You need to work out, is this book just written for you? Is it just written for Tom for the future, for him to understand? Is it written for, you know, for people of faith or people with no faith or people of what? What is it? Who's it written for? So basically I had just blah to the paper. She said, but there's a lot of good in there. She said, I suggest you go to it again, work out your audience, then we'll find you an editor. And she said, this book should be published. So I think it was those two. It was the bookends of it were, you write well and it should be published, encouraged me because for me it was quite a lonely journey writing. So it wasn't something that I talked to Roddy and Tom about at all. I didn't want to, I suppose, drag them through the process all the time. So I wasn't unloading on them at all. It was a very alone thing for me, which was important to me to write. It wasn't them that chose to write. So I think that's quite an important thing to sort of understand. And then when it got to a good second draft and Lauren reread it and she said, yep, this is good enough for editing, she then amazingly must have been telling her colleagues or staff or whatever about this book and trying to find a good editor. And at the time what happened was one of her staff members was at a conference in Sydney, which had various speakers. And one of the speakers was a lady called Belinda Pollard, who is an editor of books here in Brisbane, who became my editor. But she was speaking about editing domestic violence, books on domestic violence, and so how to care for the editor. So her talk, as far as I understand, her lecture at that conference was, if you're going to be editing stories of domestic violence, it's going to be very, very difficult. You need to give yourself time. So whilst a normal book might take you, say a normal book of fiction may take you 6 weeks of the task of editing, you need to give yourself at least 3 to 4 months. You need to be able to step away from it. How to care for the editor in this process. Well, Lauren's colleague listened to this lecture and thought, oh, editing trauma. I understand. She hadn't read my book, but I understand there's a lot of trauma in it because it's about the death of young children. Maybe this person might be a good link up for EJ. And so came back to the office and said, I think I found your person. And guess what? She lives in Brisbane. So this Brisbane person was speaking in Sydney with connected up to a staff member of my old school friend when we were back in New Zealand as teenagers, which is incredible. And I think the other amazing thing was that Belinda actually is also a woman of faith. So my story, whilst it's very much trying to tell the story of my boys and how they died and how I've coped with it afterwards, there's also being a second layer definitely woven through, which has been how do I hold on to who I am and who I have, how I have found my way in life. How do I hold on to that when the things I want and the things I've asked of are not happening? So faith is definitely a thread throughout the book that is very strong. And so I felt like it was really important that whoever did edit it understood that in a compassionate way, I suppose. It didn't necessarily have to agree with me in any shape or form, and that's certainly not why I've written the book, for people to agree with my version on life. But certainly I felt it had to understand that. I met up with Belinda much later, and then she read the first draft. I suspect with this book she's read it more than she's read many, many other books that she's ever edited, because she said, well, I owe her a lot of tissues apparently, but I think she really knows the boys now. She was just brilliant. She dealt with it probably at a lot more hours than she actually charged me because she truly believed in it as well and wanted the story to be told and told well. So I was very, very fortunate with that. But I think COVID came in the midst of that as well. Let's mention that. So Belinda was still editing it. So the editing process is she has your manuscript and she goes through and makes comments. So she never changed a word in that text, which I kind of had hoped she would, because by that time I was a little over it, having reread it. But all she would do is a comment, say, can we expand this? Or, you know, you talk about going to London, whatever, expand this. Or she would also put in a comment, say, so what time are we at now? What's the date now? Because I hadn't realized my train of thought was just going away. We hadn't brought it back to context. So she was good at doing that. And then I would flesh out that section and go back to her. So that's the editing process. Yes.
I was just saying, I read your book after you launched it, and there is a wonderful synthesis of understanding the environment at the time, which came through in your discussion just recently about the sights and the sounds and the yes. smells. I mean, I actually did feel that during the book. But I also wanted to ask you a question, which I think you've now answered, about you obviously must have started writing it for you and obviously had to then change it for the audience. I would imagine that would have taken a bit of time, someone telling you, but you probably wouldn't have been, I'm just thinking of another writer. I mean, I've always wanted to write a book. would you start thinking about, you're doing it for one reason, but in fact the capacity of the book to regenerate and give learnings yes. to others relies not on you writing it for you, doesn't it? It relies on you understanding what an audience member might yeah. want to be looking to gain from it. So
definitely.
Was it the editorial that kind of made that realization, or do you think it was time? Like, because it was yeah. quite a long time between when you
yes.
put pen to paper and you yes. articulated all those feelings that you had at that mm. very traumatic and emotional time, mm. which it still is. That will yes. never go away. But do you think that did that harness your change of focus, and was that
yes.
did that make it simpler to then write, or did it make it more difficult?
It's a good question. I think arranging in my head the audience was important, because I'd already had that pleasure of writing my story, and I still have that first draft. If I ever need to read that, it's there and all the struggles I had. But I also was aware as the years went by that maybe I was a bit harsh at the beginning or whatever. Maybe I needed to soften that in some way, or maybe I needed to explain that better. But I was also always aware that the quality of the book was the rawness, that you were actually there and that you knew how I felt at that time, and that never changed. So I wanted to be true to myself as that age, that person going through it. So anything that Belinda raised, I would double question to say, has she just not got it? Has she gone with me correctly or not? So I would push back. So for example, one area that she didn't want is a full chapter, which is where I just go to town about telling the world why the rest of the world love Ben. It's a chapter about where I share a poem that was written by his teacher at the time when he died. It shares little excerpts of all the cards that we were given by his friends. One I particularly love is, I think she said something like, Ben always, I hope Ben in his next world makes everyone smile as he's made us smile in this world or something like that. And then someone said, I think I kissed him one day at school or something like, you know, lovely little act that only 5 and 6 year olds can write. Some lovely, I think they said that, you know, we hope Ben's bouncing around in the fluffy clouds or something like that. I wanted to share what others had thought of him. Whereas Belinda thought it broke the train of story, but the mother's heart won over because it's still my book. And I'm thrilled. She said, she suggested, oh, maybe we should put it as an annexure at the back or whatever. But I actually felt like it was a time that, you know, I'm sorry, reader, you're going to have to spend 10 minutes reading about a mother's joy of her child. But I just wanted people to understand why he had been so special. And I felt like people had done that. So there was pushback on it. But the one bit was when I remembered my audience, I was very caught probably in the idea that I understand the faith and the hope that I have, but I knew that not everyone else would. So I wanted to write that it was accessible to all. I know that not everyone will find it a journey that they understand or travel with me, but I wanted to at least give it the best shot that they could. So I explain why I'm feeling that way. So little things like, why did I re-engage in singing, in going to church? You know, like if I'm thinking that God has not answered my prayers to heal my children, why would I engage with him anymore? So I answer those questions, but I try and answer it in the simplest way possible because I want it to be accessible. So I tried to bring it as a writer. I think sometimes we can all go so far and put all words to explain it, but actually the best writing is rewriting and simplifying. And that's the same with law as well. We always say that the best law is plain English. So plain English. So instead of drafting lots of words, which I think a lot of people outside of law think is what it is, actually the best law is the one that anyone on the street could understand. It's just we get caught up in too many words. So I think clarity was also what I was seeking, because I really want people to understand me and why that was a challenge for me. And sometimes that's just stripping away the superfluous words and being simple. And I think some of the best text is, like, I think I might describe how one of my children might have reacted to something, and then I'll say, and Tom was 6. That's the simplest line, but you just go, okay, I get it. He's only a 6-year-old and he's experienced all this. No wonder he's going to say it that way. It's a sort of an afterthought, but it's very poignant, I think.
Yeah, and from a reader's perspective, I mean, I heard your story on the day of the book launch and the stories of many others who love you. Mm-hmm. And I got a feeling that people were so proud of you and your parents and your husband and your beautiful son who spoke so beautifully that day. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until I read the book that I actually felt that Samuel and Ben would have been so proud about this being written about mm-hmm. their family. It's Thank not you. About them. Yeah. It's about, so, I mean, I don't know if that's what your goal was, but I felt like I know your family. And I say that yeah. as a family of 5. I don't say that yes. as a family that's small, that lost beautiful members. It's almost like that book is a one way of articulating their hopes and dreams, as well as your beautiful experience of what, hard as it is, of your experience. So thank you for even going to the effort of harnessing your experience to create something that really is a beautiful and simple read. I think mm-hmm. it is a yes. simple, complicated, but simple.
Yes.
And I would just love to ask you what's more, because I do love the story about how it got its title.
Yes. Well, that was the other thing that was while I was writing, was burning in my head as to how to name this book. And I just wanted Ben to name it. I was very certain that I wanted it to be something that he had said to us along the way. And for a long time, I wanted the book to be called I Just Can't Wait to Cuddle Samuel, because that's one of the last things Ben said to us before he died, because he thought he was going to a place called heaven where Samuel would be. And I wanted it to be called that. But Belinda, my editor, said, well, people will think that it's you that said that. And it's you that can't wait to cuddle Samuel. And poor Ben couldn't care about him. So she said, I think it will give the wrong message. So she said, I wouldn't go with that. And then I had another thought for a title, but again, it had not been a statement that Ben had given to me. And it was in rereading the book that I read just a small little paragraph that I'd included, which occurred during Ben's cancer treatment. So we were living away from home while he was going through his radiation. So I was living near the hospital, which was a two-hour journey from our house. And Ben and I were on our own a lot of the time there in this little flat. And if you know anything about different treatments through cancer or other types of illnesses, a lot of the drugs that people who are going through this treatment have can really affect your taste buds or cause nausea. And so Ben had all of that right from the beginning of his first radiation treatment. He was sick. He went off his food. So he was a strong-looking rugby-billed boy and went to a very, very thin, skinny boy through cancer treatment. And one of the battles that I had was we had a lot of time. My one job was to look after him and to make him healthy and well. And this is what the doctor said. If he's strong, he's going to have a whole year of chemotherapy treatment, which is, I think it was 9 different lots of chemo he was due over, you know, however many months. And he needs a year of being a strong body to be able to face what the treatment he has. So we need him to be strong. You need to build him up between treatments because I think we had a sort of 4-week or 5-week break between treatments because he had three day of full infusion going on the whole 3 days. So no time out in three days. So you've got to make him strong. So me, who had stepped out of work for the 6 weeks of radiation and was just at home in this little flat with Ben, where he had sort of 20 minutes treatment and the rest of the day is just thinking about building up this child, I wanted to feed him. I had that total urge to feed him, but nothing worked. And as time went over, he just would effectively refuse to eat and just push food around the bowl and that sort of thing. And it upset me a lot because I'm trying to get that to him. And then the other thing is he would be, anything he did eat, he'd often be sick. So you have to have the anti-sickness medicine, which was another medicine that you have to negotiate with a 6-year-old child, some yucky tasting whatever. And so in this point of disaster for me, where I'm not necessarily coping so well, we've just got to get you to bed. So he's in the bathroom of the flat and I'm trying to tell him to brush his teeth. This is the first time ever he just hadn't brushed his teeth normally. And he just said, but it doesn't taste good, whatever. And he was refusing to sort of brush his teeth or just delaying. And I'm feeling really frustrated probably. But he just turned to me and said, as if out of nowhere, will I have to brush my teeth in heaven? I think he said, mummy before, will I have to brush my teeth in heaven? And it just hit me because at the time I was hoping he wouldn't be in heaven for a long, long time. But I think he was thinking about Samuel, his brother who was in heaven in his mind. And he thought, does Samuel have to do this? That's what I think he thought. But I decided that night not to push the brushing of the teeth. And together with Ben, we sat on the bath, like on the ridge of the bath together. And I think I would have put my arm around him. And we discussed whether you have to brush your teeth in heaven or not. Because in my mind or my knowledge from what I've read is a future world will have no decay. And therefore, there'll be no tooth decay. So fairly soon we did decide that you wouldn't have to brush your teeth in heaven. It was our decision that basically those days were over. We would have had a laugh like you did there, Marissa. And with our conclusion, we would have had a hug. Ben was full of hugs. That's his love language. And I bet you the teeth didn't get brushed that night. He got away with it.
I think it was evidence of you trying to be firm.
Yes.
And trying to be fair.
Yes.
But you're probably more fairer than firm that night.
Yes. And yes.
I love the way that is the title of the book because yes. I think it's captivating and beautiful.
Yeah.
And thank you for sharing that story.
That's good.
Because it is just beautiful. So, EJ, I think Ben's passing had an incredible impact also on your local community. And yeah. I believe that you did something about that.
Yes, we had quite an outpouring of people telling us we want to do something in memory of him. And so we started to think what would be the most help in terms of an ongoing legacy, really, in relation to Ben. And it was actually Roddy, my husband, that said, well, actually, to be honest, the greatest help for us was the flat that we were able to use near the Royal Marsden Hospital, which was about a 2-hour drive at best from our location in Eastbourne, which is on the coast of England. So driving into London, it was a 2-hour commute each way. And Roddy said the provision of that flat was the best help. And he said, maybe we could buy a flat. And I looked at him and thought, what? This is, you know, a flat just out on the outskirts of London. And at the time we were thinking around £200,000 to get a 2-bedroom flat, which I thought was a crazy amount of money. But in faith, we sort of said, well, let's see what the community thinks. And Ben's really good friend, Rufus, his mum, was always doing a cafe once a year anyway, and her family, the family all helping out. In their garden and setting up tables, etc., and that was freely provided, and the money would that was raised at that cafe for the afternoon would go to a charity. So of course they said, we want it for Ben's charity, and usually they would raise about £400-£500 of this event. Well, they raised £1,200 for something called the Ben McNichol Trust, which didn't even really exist at that time. It was just this idea of Roddy's, this is what we're going to do. And that was in the July, and Benny had only died at the end of the May. So we didn't have this together. So very rapidly we had to put together the trust formally. Fortunately, I'm the lawyer, so I was able to get the trust deed in place and trustees, et cetera, and bank accounts separate, et cetera, and begin raising money for the Ben McNichol Trust. And what was wonderful about that is, whilst I found a lot of people couldn't talk or verbalise much about the loss of Ben or Samuel, they could talk about the trust. So people who didn't want, for some reason, to actually say how you're dealing with it or how you're coping with the passing of Ben or Samuel, they'd be able to say, how's the trust going? And they'd be able to show that they cared by talking about that. And look, it only actually ended up taking 4 years to raise £250,000. Wow. Because the increase of cost had come up. And we raised £250,000 to be able to purchase a flat that's literally 2 minutes walk from the hospital. Interestingly, the flats that we had stayed in were just across the road. And so Ben and I would have walked past this on our way to radiation, but we wouldn't have known that that was going to be his gift back to that community. And the reason we had to walk is Ben went through the treatment in February where there was snow. So it didn't matter that we had our car parked there. You couldn't actually drive to the hospital, so you had to walk. It's a lovely, lovely place. It's managed by the Royal Marsden Hospital, so they give it to families of children who have cancer and they're going through treatment. Our understanding is people from other countries as well have stayed there, so we're expecting there's been some Australian families that may have stayed at Ben's house. We call it Ben's house now, but it's beautiful. And the key is given to families totally free of charge. We pay for all the services, et cetera, et cetera. They just get that gift during a time when it's really difficult for them. So the trust has been a wonderful thing. And interestingly, actually only a couple of weeks ago, the local school where Ben and Tom went to, St. John's Meads in Eastbourne, contacted me, friends, saying, we're doing a cake stall for Ben's trust, which is amazing. And one of the teachers there, she always talks about Ben to the receptions. That's like the prep class reception year. She said we always, as part of the introductory to the school, we walk down to the school field and we sit around what there's a tree that's planted in memory of Benny down there with a wooden seat around it, a blossom tree. And she said we sit around it and we talk about Ben. And she said, and we tell them why this is so important in this school. And she shares that every year. And she said it's amazing because it actually brings up stories of these young people, like 5 and 6 year olds, about losses they may have had in their life. And she said it's a wonderful discussion that happens, you know, regularly in memory of Ben. But she said it's helped children in so many ways. So giving back and the things of the community has been really, really wonderful.
And what a lovely cycle to go back to your time in England.
Yes.
When you were also dealing with 5 and 6 year olds.
Yes, that's true.
In a very different and nevertheless still a very meaningful way. It's a beautiful cycle of life in many respects.
That's true.
But and also that's not the, you know, the stopping point for your philanthropic engagement. Of course, you're also involved in Brisbane in the beautiful charity Precious Wings.
Yes, so I'm very fortunate to have come across Precious Wings through introduction, actually through an accountant friend here in Brisbane who invited me, knowing our story briefly, knowing that Roddy and I had lost two younger children. I was a last-minute invite to one of the Precious Wings lunches. I think it was the 2018. Someone else had pulled out and they called me up the night before and said, would you like to take this ticket? I had no idea what Precious Wings was and what they did. So I turned up. It's the most amazing event they have yearly now in October, so very close to important dates of infant loss days. But anyway, we have had it for the last few years in the W Hotel, and this one was at the W Hotel, over 400 people. I went to that event knowing nothing and not knowing what to expect. I came away feeling fully embraced and loved by Precious Wings. Precious Wings is a Brisbane-based charity that provides to hospitals and funeral homes throughout Queensland memory boxes for families who have lost children from whatever gestation. So we do miscarriage bags right through to some older children as well. It's unfortunately only growing. So we now support over 60 hospitals, is my understanding, and I don't know the number of funeral homes in totality, but it really meets a need in the hospitals. So one of the most important things that people universally tell me is the feeling of aloneness that people feel when they lose a child, not just at that moment when you leave the hospital, but also going on into the future. And the important thing of a Precious Wings box is that it provides connection. So each box is dedicated to another child who has also gone too soon. So, for example, if I'm making a box in a support group at Precious Wings, I might write Benjamin's name, or I might write Samuel's name, Samuel McNichol. And then another family will say, wow, some family survived enough to be able to do this and gift this to us. We have a connection. And there's lots of other things there. Well, from that luncheon, I was put in touch with Kerry Gordon, who's the CEO of Precious Wings here in Brisbane, and eventually joined their board a couple of years ago now. So there's only 6 of us on the board, and we have got some wonderful input from community and help, but really it's doing a wonderful, wonderful work in Brisbane and Queensland in terms of meeting that need of aloneness for families. And a lot of people say to us, it was the only thing that gave me hope when I left without my child. I clutched onto that box, or I clutched onto that teddy that was within that box. I didn't let go because that was all I could hold on to. So we're really trying to meet that need. We have been approached by many other states throughout Australia because this is not something that's replicated. It's been purely up until this year, voluntary run. And that means raising money, et cetera, et cetera. So I think our claim to fame last year is that our tickets for the luncheon sold out faster than Ed Sheeran. 2 minutes, was it, on the thing? So there's a lot of love and support for that event. So it was over 400 last year. This year we're going to be at City Hall, so we can have more, which is exciting and kind of scary because it's a different function venue to be able to work with. But yeah, they raise good money, but it's a continually growing need. So we have new hospitals or new funeral homes which will contact us regularly that we never want to say no to. So, yeah, it's definitely meeting a need. And my husband, Brody, is also involved at Precious Wings in that he goes to some of the support groups as a facilitator, really encouraging also men to be involved in that process as well, because it's very hard sometimes to be able to talk about loss, but that's a safe environment to do it with other people who may have experienced loss as well.
Well, thank you for doing so much to support our local community, as well as it's almost an indictment of your life, isn't it? I have a million other questions I want to ask you, but I can't. I've got to try and pull this in. I'm so happy that we've had this conversation. I hope you've enjoyed it.
Yes.
I know it's not easy, and I think there'll be a lot of people who will just relish the opportunity to have got to know you and your family a little bit better. But I would love to ask you, because you've had so much under your belt now with family and friends and your work and the world generally speaking and dealing with so much grief, more than anybody should ever have to bear. But what do you want to be when you grow up?
I want to be wise, and I don't yet know what that is. I keep seeking it. But, yeah, I want to be that wise grandma. Maybe not a grandma, but I want to be that wise older mentor person that people seek out, but that I give wisdom back. And I know that I can't do that on my own strength. So a verse that I have always held on to has been, I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. And I think that no matter what stage in life I'm in, I will be holding on to that as my banner. And what I like about it is I can do all things, but not through me, through a deeper power that gives me that strength to get through it. But, yeah, I seek wisdom, and I think as we grow older, that's the gift that we're hopefully given. So, yes, I would seek to be a wise person.
Thank you for sharing that. But I also got the impression from the book that there was always an underlying. I always used to ask myself, how do you keep on going? And I realised that you had an incredible thread of faith that obviously has been with you for a long time. I was with that kind of forever. Is that correct? But
Since six years old.
But I think it was very evident in the book, but an incredible, powerful tool and a powerful force for you that you were going through so much even then when you said you were away for weeks, you know, with Ben, which would have been a very challenging time for you to look after yourself too when you were so consumed, as we always would be as mothers, taking care of others. So I do sense that incredible sense of faith. And I think I think maybe at times when there was perhaps nothing else left for you to believe in.
To hold on to.
Correct?
Yeah. I think what's also important is that a lot of people think that whatever faith you have or whatever beliefs you have in this world, a lot of people think that is what gets you through. But part of what I also wanted to make clear in the book is that that's also the thing that can unbalance you. So if you put all your hope into something and that hope disappoints and that hope lets you down, what do you cling on to then? What is the thing that can hold you right through that? So, for example, one of the things I mentioned in the book is I had a friend that said, well, everyone else would fall apart, but it's because you have that faith that that's held you together, which is true. But I also wanted to make it clear that it's not an easy faith. That I get angry at God, that I swear at God, that I'm ashamed of that, that I'm frustrated because he didn't do what I wanted him to do and what everyone wanted him to do, what even the doctors thought, particularly with Ben, not with Samuel so much, because inevitably the doctors said any further intervention would be futile. But with Ben, they gave him quite high chance of survival. And so the fact that that horrible twist happened only within weeks of having had a clear scan is just awful, you know. And so I suppose I wanted to make it very real for those purposes. And interestingly, one of the many pieces of feedback I've already received from readers of the book is from a mother who also is somebody of faith but lost twin boys. I never met at the time, but she was in my circle. I had actually written to them when I was in the UK and they were in New Zealand. I'd actually written to them after their loss because I thought they're going to struggle. I just knew, and I don't even know what I wrote, but I wrote to them, and I'd never met her, but I wrote because I knew that it was going to be tough. And she has, through, again, my circle of connections, she's been able to connect re-again to someone else who gave her the book. She wrote to me a card that I received only last week in the mail. It was amazing. It was wonderful because she said to me, "You just wrote everything I've always wanted to say." She said, instead of the fluff that I was given at the time where people tried to brush over my pain and my hurt because they said, "It must be wonderful. You're believing your children in heaven and you're going to go and join them and it's all going to be bouncy, fluffy clouds. It's all this," she said, "this fluff." She said, "I had the same anger and the hurt and you've expressed it. Thank you." She said, "Thank you for listening to us." And so I suppose, yeah, I think it's that duality of having strength and faith and hope, yes, but actually that sometimes being your challenge as well, which has hopefully thread through the book, that it's a very genuine, honest response to faith as opposed to, "Well, that's why it worked for her." Yes. No, honest.
I sensed that honesty about it, and I think that was really helpful to me, even understanding other pieces of the world. I mean,
exactly.
Other pieces of loss we've all experienced in other regimes, even if it's parental loss. I mean, the same kind of genre, it's the same sort of genre at the
it
end
is.
Of the day
yep.
about how you deal with that interruption to life's what hopes and dreams. I'm pretty sure that the book has articulated so much of the answer to the last question about what brings you happiness, but I want to ask that with a bit of a disclaimer, because so much of your book says the challenge to finding happiness again. It's a theme in the book. And so I feel almost not right asking you the question about what brings you happiness, because I so clearly know from reading the book, the small part of you, I know what brings you happiness. I know the answer to this question, but I want to ask it in the context of challenging happiness again through your book. It's such a theme that I do need to ask the question about what is happiness to EJ at this moment in time.
I think for me, it's certainly a theme that I work through in the book. And I talk about the challenge of being happy, like the concept of just happiness. And I think I've been very blessed in that I had a happy childhood. I had a happy young adulthood. I had happy deliveries of my first two children. I've had a lot of happiness. I didn't always realize it was happiness, but I've had a lot of carefreeness. And the way I describe that is that idea of, you know, the feeling of hope or joy when you're truly a child and Christmas is coming and you're about to open those gifts, that sure excitement, that happiness is something. Since the first scan with Samuel, I suspect I haven't experienced, because that really probably did change my view on what happiness is. But what I made clear in the kind of conclusion for the happiness, it only concludes in the last pages, is that I finally accepted that I can be content. It's a different word than happy. Contentment is, to me, much deeper, much richer, and much wiser than happiness, because I feel that happiness is fleeting, but contentment is long-lasting. So contentment for me would be knowing that all the time and the effort that I've spent in writing this book has not been wasted. Contentment would be dealing with some of the reactions that haven't actually been easy. So I've had some numpties, even in reading the book. Contentment for me would be knowing that that mother that wrote to me has been heard, has been understood, has not been given fluff, and that she's not alone. And I think contentment is about that, knowing that we can connect and and care for each other, whatever journeys or paths our lives have taken.
Jane, thank you for not only giving us your time today, but for giving a beautiful gift to the world through your beautiful first book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marisa.
If you would like to find out more about the Ben McNichol Trust or the Precious Wings Foundation and all the great work they do, you can find both links in the episode description below. Thank you for joining us on today's episode. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. As usual, if you have any questions, you can send them through to podcast@hanworthhouse.com.au. That's HANWORTH. We'll be back soon with another special guest.
Cheers.
Cheers.